Goodness. Marvelous applause. Sounded like the sort they add in comedy shows. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to talk to you for a bit of things that remind me of the past, I suppose. Because like most people of about my age, 75, I can't remember what happened yesterday afternoon at all. But I can remember 1932, day by day, almost, and certainly everybody that was at school with me, I can remember almost all. It's as if one saw the past through the wrong end of binoculars, you know. The distance is immensely clear, the foreground totally blurred. But I will be talking about the background. I accumulated fairly early in my life my passions, those things which have given me enormous pleasure or driven me forward, and I would like to sketch them out. My wife is furious about my passions because they've never changed. She says I'm the biggest conservative of the small sea she's ever met. To start with fishing. When I was 8, 7, my father took me fishing. He was fishing with a fly. He gave me a worm on a hook, and I caught a 3.5-pound brown trout on the River Clwyd. Clwyd, Wales, as you might imagine. Somebody once said of Welsh names, they looked like the letters left over from Scrabble. Well, there I was in the Rhlwyd, and I landed this enormous trout, and of course it hooked me for life. In fact, I just wrote a book called Hooked, My Fishing Reminiscences. I do know something, however, that although apparently more people fish than watch football, but in small groups, that's why you don't notice them, they don't run around the street vomiting into areas. I know, however, that most people who don't fish, if you start to even mention it, their eyes glaze over. They get sort of mental cataracts. And they usually say something to show their disapproval of people who can waste their time fishing. They usually say, "I haven't got the patience," in a very aggressive way, as if somehow it was a moral virtue not to have the patience to fish. In fact, patience doesn't come into it. Anticipation does. But that, I think, is the last I shall say about fishing. You'll be relieved to hear. Now, the next thing I'm going to add to that is jazz. Some of you have seen me in younger days jumping about vigorously. I still sing, but now I sit down. I like the sympathy vote. No, actually, I did it. Because last year at Ronnie Scott's, I'd had a bad attack of asthma, very bad, hospital and oxygen and all that. And all my friends kept turning up. I kept saying, "Why are they all coming to see me?" I realised that my wife had told all my best friends to come and see me in case this was the end. However, I recovered against the odds. But at Ronnie's, I did suddenly fall down to the ground and I was sober. Ronnie Scott's. So from now on, I walk on stage exaggeratedly delicately, I think, you know, wobbling around, and sit down and sing the whole concert sitting in a chair. I love it. At the time also, because one of my eyes had gone wrong, it wasn't a good year last year, I had to wear an eye patch, a piratical-looking eye patch. So there I was, hobbling on and wearing an eye patch. That's a long John Silver in his dotage. But jazz. I took a liking to jazz before I knew what it was. When I was very young, jazz was the music of the day. But I didn't take it in. I listened mostly to Henry Hall, who every afternoon played popular music of the day. I liked his comedy numbers to start with, like Hush, 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 Here Comes the Bogeyman, or Teddy Bear's Picnic. But later on, I became enamored of some of the romantic tunes he played, which were very beautiful, I think, so still, like Pennies from Heaven, the Isle of Capri, and so on. Beautiful songs. And so I listened to them. But at school, I was at a preparatory school in Liverpool run by a bald-headed brute. And I discovered later a secret drinker, hence his mood swings. He William Weston Twine, thought all we needed to know in order to become instant gentlemen was how to appreciate and play, if possible, a good game of rugger, as he called it, how to keep a straight bat in cricket, and how to translate Latin prose. And I'm glad to say I don't remember a word of Latin. I detest football and cricket, so I resisted his influence. But I didn't resist what he disapproved of. And if it was raining and rain had stopped play at Lord's or the Oval or wherever it was, he used to turn on, he'd have the radio turned on all during lunch. You had to listen. Beautifully paced ball in. Yes, knocked it off to the slips, caught and sent back again, you know. Heavens above. And he used to ask me where people were playing, you know, who's at silly meet off? I didn't know or care. But if rain stopped play, the voice would say, we are now returning to the studio, and the orchestra of Roy Fox or Ambrose, whoever it was, at which Mr. Twine would hurl his not inconsiderable weight at the radio and try to turn it off. Luckily, the handle usually came off, you know, the little knob he was meant to be turning came off in his hand, so one continued to listen for a minute or two while he cursed and swore what he called this filthy jizz. Jizz. He was one of those people who used an E instead of an A. But I didn't really hear it consciously until I got to the public school my parents sent to me, a very sympathetic place, I thought, called Stowe, set in beautiful grounds full of follies and temples, and built for the Duke of Buckingham, but it became a school in the 20s. And I went there and I learned to appreciate architecture. You see, one was surrounded by great beauties of architecture. But at the same time, one day, a boy asked me into his study, not for the usual reasons. And I said, I want you to listen to this. He wound up his little HMV portable and put on a red HMV, I think again, record and put the needle on it. And out came this astounding noise. It seemed to me pretty incomprehensible the first time. But then he explained that what the instruments were doing was playing along the same chords, but not the same notes or melody exactly. They were counterparting each other and so on. And this was jazz. And what they played, by the end of the evening, I was totally convinced that this was a wonderful music, was by a man called Muggsy Spanier. That was another thing I liked, the names. Muggsy. Terrific. And Muggsy played a record on that occasion. One side was called Eccentric, which I thoroughly approved of course. And the other was called I Wish I Could Shimmy Like My Sister Kate. Equally irresistible, you see. And within the next week, I discovered there was a whole movement going on in the school. Just a few people here and there were on to early jazz. Swing was, of course, the music of the time, Benny Goodman and Harry James and so on. But we were discovering that in the 20s, there was this incredible noise. And within a week, I'd heard Louis Armstrong through one study window and gone in and asked to listen to it, called Drop That Sack. And then I heard Bessie Smith, the great blues singer of the 20s. She was really incredible. She must have been a difficult woman. She drank a lot, which I intended to follow in her footsteps as soon as I was old enough. She had a very short fuse to her temper. She was handy with her fists, and she was bisexual. I was never very handy with my fists ever, but and quite good-tempered. In fact, if she were alive today, I'm sure she'd be on the front bench of one of the two parties. Still, I heard her. I heard that great voice soaring and growling in a number she recorded fairly late in her life called Gimme a Pig Foot and a Bottle of Beer. So there I was in my imagination in Harlem, gnawing on a pig's foot and drinking a bottle of beer. I'm very fond of pig's feet, by the way, and beer, so it wasn't a lesson that went amiss. What I didn't know, though, was that this music was catching on with young people all over this country and all over Europe, too. It was the secret music of the young opposition to Hitler, who hated jazz, decadent music, Negro music at that, which of course he detested. But for us, the black race was instantly elevated to demigods, and the music they played sacred. And I began to collect it. So there I was, settled with jazz, you see, as well. And then when I came to London, I discovered people, notably Humphrey Lyttelton, were actually playing this music. I wanted to be part of that, but I couldn't learn an instrument. I've no mathematical sense, no musical sense, really. So I thought I'd sing, and I did begin to sing. And I eventually joined a band called Mick Mulligan, and I was with Mick Mulligan for 12 riotous years. We terrorized the whole country. Well, we were always falling over. We took drink on stage, and which we weren't meant to do, and so on. And we actually attracted young, anarchic young men and women, women, I'm glad to say, because by this time I'd slowly moved from being entirely gay when I was young. I think my mother was largely to do with that. She adored gays, you know. She's what they now call a fag hag. And she often reminded me of that famous piece of graffiti in a New York lavatory. Someone wrote up, "My mother made me a homosexual," and somebody had written underneath, "If I bought the wool, would she make me one?" Anyway, I shifted slowly. I remained bisexual for quite a long time, and I shifted due to the fact that the head of the surrealist movement, who I'd met, a Belgian called E.L.T. Messens, and his beautiful wife, Sybil. I've written a book about them called Don't Tell Sybil. But one day they suggested we all went to bed together, the three of us. So we did. I thought it was going to be terribly difficult. I thought it would be very different. Not different. It didn't strike me as very different, except I could see her face. But from that not very tiny acorn, quite big acorn, an oak grew my heterosexuality. I don't think of it as a virtue, just a fact. You know, I've always defended everybody's right, as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else, to do what they want. That comes out of surrealism, which was my third passion. What is surrealism? Well, it's difficult to say exactly, unless you've got several hours, but it believed you should release the unconscious and allow it equal rights with the conscience, and that desire and its fulfillment were frequently a good thing instead of a suppressed thing, that sex was a great enjoyment and beyond that an enricher of the human being, and not simply for propagation. It was very much against the missionary position as the end of all. And so it suited me very well. And politically, I joined the anarchists, a gentle body of people then, who wanted to get rid of all the authorities, as the surrealists did, all the establishment, royalty, presidents, police, prisons, armies, all these people. Get rid of them all. Let human beings discover what they were instead of what they were told to be, and the world would probably improve. Now, there's no proof it would, of course. In fact, much of the evidence since would suggest it wouldn't. But on the other hand, this ambition to free the human being is pretty, I think, pretty admirable. And you've only got to turn on the news to see what happens when you allow rationality and politics and authority and hypocrisy and all that to work. It doesn't either. So who knows, it might have worked. And anyway, surrealism invaded the world. You see the word, don't you, surrealism, attached to anything that's a bit odd, and rightly so. Anyway, I met them later. I met the leader, André Breton, a man of extraordinary dignity. He had that quality I suppose saints have, a sort of charisma, but equally, like saints, he was extremely irritating and dictatorial. But meeting him, I felt like, I don't know, a 12-year-old boy meeting one of the Spice Girls. So really then, I had the foundation for my whole life. Fishing, surrealism, jazz, a touch of anarchism, although as a friend of mine wrote quite rightly, yes, I'm an anarchist, but I'm an armchair anarchist. So, I'd become a jazz singer. Mick Mulligan and I were demons, mutually feeding off each other's wickedness. His mother thought I was the bad influence, and mine thought his was. We caroused around this country. People always think sex started in the 60s. Rubbish. They started writing long articles in the Daily Mail about it, but in fact, we found there's plenty of it. And it wasn't a question of seduction, you know, one sometimes had to jump out the way. We didn't make much money at all, and we used to have to stay in perfectly dreadful digs. In Manchester, there was a famous woman called Mrs. Mack, a nice old plump Lancashire thing, and her house was filthy. You never put your hand on the banisters, it would come off looking as if you'd been working on a propeller of a large ship. You only ate boiled eggs because you'd seen the kitchen. Among the other delights there was a free-range budgerigar. She had what we thought was a fur lampshade. Somebody touched it, and the fur fell down into the cornflakes and watered milk. It was all dust. But she was very moral. She wouldn't have us bring back girls from the club, the bodega. She said, "You're not lumbering a scrubber back here." She said, "If you've got a scrubber, go to the Essex," which was rather more liberal and a little more expensive. A great trumpet player called Ken Collier, now dead alas, who founded the traditional, as opposed to the revivalist jazz movement, took his wife to be up there the week before their marriage. And she said, "Are you married?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm married." So off they went. And the next week in the Melody Maker, there were photographs of them on the steps of Fulham Town Hall, having just married. I was staying with Mrs. Mack that weekend. She was reading the Melody Maker. It was not that she was interested in jazz particularly or music, but she wanted to see who was coming up to Manchester so she'd know how many beds to make up. Make up, by the way, with those that strange flannelette she used instead of sheets, which was damp when you got into it, but after a few minutes, very comforting because it steamed. Anyway, she saw this photograph of Ken Collier and his blushing bride. She said, "Just wait till I see that, Ken Collier," she said. "Just wait till I see him. I'll learn him coming up here for a bloody rehearsal." Now, at the beginning, to go on stage and be allowed to play early jazz was an enormous thrill, you know. I used to wait in the wings and even appeal to Bessie Smith to inspire me. That's a pretty naive thing to do. She'd been long dead in a car crash. But we played these old tunes and Mick rehearsed and we had a tuba and banjo and all the things you needed then to make the right noise. But then after 12 years... flogging the roads in an old tin can van, eating fried rubbish and staying at the equivalent of Mrs. Max, although it provided many anecdotes for the future, lost its charm. And Mick became a bit lazy. You know, we played the same program every night. And really, it gradually lost its charm. And eventually I said to him, "I think we might break up." I said this, mind you, not entirely out of the blue, because I'd already started to write the balloons and a storyline for a strip cartoon called Fluke, which was drawn by Wally Fawkes, alias Trog, the great cartoonist, who asked me to write the story, as I said. And I did that for 15 years, and it doubled my salary, you see, instantly, to what I earned with the Mulligan Band. Now, on top of that, I began to get asked by papers to write articles, by quite posh papers like Vogue and so on. So I wrote articles there, and I started on a book, and then I met my second wife. I met her in a drinking club. called the Colony Room, run by a wonderful old dyke called Muriel Belcher. Good name, isn't it, Belcher? It was better on in the telephone book. That page said, Belcher to Belikoff. So. She was very witty. One member fell asleep in a dark corner, not an unknown thing to do there, and woke up to find Muriel doing the till, and seated on the carpet in front of her were two rats from the restaurant down below, their whiskers and eyes. And I'm going to leave out a swear word here. You'll have to imagine it. Sure, it's quite easy. She did swear like a trooper. She looked at the two rats and she said, you two can go away for a start. You're not members and I've made up the till. Among other people that drank there all the time was Francis Bacon, our probably greatest painter. Lucian Freud also, and many other painters. Muriel knew nothing about pictures and nothing about books, but she had a wonderful nose for talent, young talent, which hadn't proved itself. She'd say, because she used to bar people, you know. She used to, some poor businessman would appear and say, oh, somebody told me to meet them here. I said, go away. Go away, she'd say. You're not a very pretty lady. She called everybody as if they were women. And when Bernard Shaw died, she said she was a clever little woman. So it was a very camp atmosphere, which I've always rather loved, I'm afraid to say. Possibly a hangover from my days under the thumb of my mother, or I at any rate. Not that my mother couldn't be critical. She didn't really like me being a jazz singer. She'd like me to be Noel Coward. Well, I wouldn't have minded myself, actually. He was so witty. I would say the musical was another of my major influences. I was taken to see it when I was young. I fell in love with Max Miller. I've just joined the Max Miller Society, which is formed in Brighton. Miller, I mean, his timing. And another thing about Miller, which was very important, and which I've adopted for my own particular act of jokes and songs, was to always talk to the women. Most comedians joke to the men, and the women sat like that and nudge them if they laugh too much, you see. But Miller went for the women, and when he got them laughing, the men relaxed too. What was one he used to do? Oh, yes. He used to say, I went home the other night. Now, there's a funny thing. I went home the other night. I went down a passage into the front room. There was a man there with no clothes on. I said to the wife, what's this? She says, don't lose your temper, Miller. Don't go raving mad. It's a nudist coming to use the phone. Now, that was a clever one from the wife. So the musical was there. So I more or less gave up jazz at the end of the 50s. But as the 60s wore on, I did pretty well in Fleet Street. I had a column in The Observer and then another column. I wrote about TV and films. The book came out and had wonderfully reviewed. My mother hated it. All her friends in Liverpool said, fancy educating George that expensively and writes this filth. I said, well, look, you got a very good review in The Observer and Sunday Times. I don't care about that. She said, it's what my friends say. I said, well, you don't mind, do you? Well, not if I just read it, but they've read it. You see, she was one for public opinion. She didn't like it, and my first book. She liked the articles. She liked me being on the critics. That was she'd always wanted me to be. Suddenly I found I was. I seemed in a sort of rather sinister way to fulfill many of her ambitions. But then, towards the end of the 60s, I began to get anxious to sing. The thing was that once you've been an entertainer, once you've heard that sound, which I've heard at time to time, this afternoon, laughter, and one has provoked it, it sets up a sort of hunger. And Wally Fawkes, who drew Fluke, that was a clarinetist. He had been with Humphrey Littleton. He told me that on Sunday morning, he and some friends of his made music for fun with a collection at a pub now pulled down called Merlin's New Cave near King's Cross. And when I'd finished my piece, of course, on Sunday, it came out in the papers. I had nothing to do on Sunday. I used to get on my moped. I didn't look totally dignified on a moped, I have to say, being rather round and so on. In fact, a friend of mine used to call me Sister George. But I went down the hill, and I went to this pub, and I began to sing with this band, which had fine players in it, like Bruce Turner, and particularly John Chilton, a trumpet player who had led a swing band in the earlier days, a sort of Harlem swing band, and also played with Bruce Turner and so on, playing very well. And I sang with them, and it derived a certain applause from the audience. And we began to get asked to appear in different venues, in universities and art centres. And we thought, that's wonderful, we're back where we were, but now we can behave as badly as we want again because we're not bored anymore, we're enthralled. And so we set about it, and then we were offered a lot of work, and I resigned from the Observer, and all the band resigned from their day jobs. We went back and behaved badly on the road again, only we were middle-aged. And there came a point, especially after one night at Ronnie Scott's, when I slid under the piano and John Chilton had to announce to the audience, I'm afraid the captain is no longer in charge of the ship. There came a point when several friends advised me, and I sort of took it in as well, that if we didn't, well, sober up a bit and take it seriously, we wouldn't be on the road for very long. So we did, and John and I have been together with changing personnel otherwise, but long, most of it with us for a long time. We have been together now nearly 30 years, and this year's our 28th year at Ronnie Scott's Christmas. You see, so sobering up did pay dividends, and besides which I didn't sober up too much. But had to perhaps hold on to the piano rather than slide under it. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been a wonderful audience. I could, of course, go on twice as long, but you were relieved to hear I haven't got the time to do so. And so I'll wish you adieu. Thank you.